City Council come back from recess, picking up the morning agenda. If we could read item, which one is the service coordination?
1247.
Can you please read the title?
1477.
Can you please read the title for, no, it's not.
1477.
Oh, 1477?
Yeah.
Okay. 1477, authorize a grant to Central City Concern not to exceed $1,259,441 for treatment readiness services, transitional housing, and follow-up retention support services to chemically dependent homeless adult chronic arrestees and provide for payment.
Commissioner Dan Seltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. This grant is to continue the very important element of the service coordination team, which is the rapid housing response, which Central City Concern has been successfully delivering. And actually, we had Bill Sennett here, who is the program manager for the service coordination team, but I believe he wasn't coming back till 2. But since it's been requested we deal with this first, we'll go ahead and deal with this. But it's been a very successful program, an integral element of the service coordination team, and I would urge council to continue this investment.
Any council discussion on item number 1477, emergency ordinance? Carl, is anyone signed up to testify?
Dan Handelman.
Mr. Handelman. Anyone else wish to testify on council calendar item 1477?
Hi.
Hi. Hello, Mayor Adams and commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman again from Portland Cop Watch. And we've testified several times now about elements of the service coordination team. Our biggest concern is that in order to get on a list for treatment, police have to arrest somebody over and over and over again. They don't have to be convicted of anything, and then they get threatened with a felony charge, and then that's how they get into treatment, when there's lots of people who probably want to get into treatment and can't. There's some people who probably use a higher grade of drug that aren't on the streets that can afford to pay for their own treatment, but the people who might want treatment but can't afford it have to get arrested over and over again through this program. But what can particularly kind of shed light on another concern we have about the program is that this is under the Bureau of Police. And it's confusing why a social service program is being funded through the police bureau instead of being funded as a social service program unto itself. It's giving the police more control and say over who's going to get these services. And we would just hope that the city would have this grant money to give directly to the Central City Concern without being part of the Bureau of Police. And especially we know that, you know, police services don't have that much money for themselves. We don't understand how they have $1.2 million to grant to Central City Concern.
I put it in the police bureau's budget. That's how.
Mm-hmm.
Right or wrong, that's why I did it. It was a standalone special appropriation, and I felt that it was it lacked oversight. So I appreciate your comments. Did you have any more you wanted to add?
I do hope that someday the entire service coordination team effort will, like the sidewalk, be put into one place so the community can understand all the elements of it and how it works. And, we've actually talked with Commissioner Saltzman about the question about the secret nature of the list of people and maybe at least the statistics of what kind of people are being arrested, their income levels, their race, their gender, their age could be posted, even if the names aren't, if that's a privacy concern. So at least we would see whether the information that's been put out in the public that it's 55% African Americans on the list is true. And if that seems to be continuing what happened in the drug-free zones that this program more or less replaced.
Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Saltzman, would you like to comment on the issue of reporting of arrests or participants?
I informed my colleagues a while ago that I don't believe that the names on the list should be publicized. I think there is a certain right to privacy inherent in that that would be violated. But as to whether there's statistical information on race and things like that, I'm not sure we really have that information, but that's something I will continue to try to be responsive to.
So if I could, I'm going to approve this today. I think the program has shown great success, but I would like to see reporting based on socio-demographic factors like race so that we can provide the kind of due diligence that I think is necessary. So, Any other council?
Mayor, do you want to do that as an amendment?
Yes, sure. I move.
If you want to make an amendment, I would move to do what Mayor Adams proposes, to have a demographics listed along with the names of those on the list.
I'm okay without the names, so we might have to vote separately on those items.
Well, I just made a motion, and I'll speak to it first.
Okay. Second.
There actually is no legal justification for not disclosing the names. Arrests are public record. So the fact that what we heard just now is that their private information is not accurate. To allow the list to become an issue itself allows for the program itself to be questioned. I initiated this program. It is a great program. It has singularly turned people's lives around that were hopeless and helpless. It gives people, because of the carrot and stick approach, a chance to get their life back, and I've talked to those people. Some of the most severely dependent people on drugs and alcohol, and usually with a spattering of mental illness, have found a life because of this program. And that the commissioner in charge and the police bureau holds to this position, that somehow these names need to be kept secret, is not serving the best interest of the program or even the people in the program. These are people that generally are living on the streets, selling and buying drugs, who are well known to police officers, who have a history of decades of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, mental abuse, and I say it's time to just publish the names on the list because they're arrest records. Every arrest record is by its nature a public document. So I support Mayor Adams' effort to have the race, the gender, and all the demographics, but it's time we end this charade of allowing those who would attack this program for their own reasons to hang their hat on the so-called secret list. It's foolish.
So I think those are compelling arguments. I remain nervous about the... And you and I didn't get a chance to talk. So I remain nervous around the HIPAA sort of medical issues. What were your reasons for keeping it private?
Well, let me say, I think, you know, it is arrest information is public, and the criteria under which somebody is on this list is public. So a good reporter or a citizen can easily put together a Freedom Information request and request that information. But, you know, these people are brothers and sisters, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, and I think to just hand over a list that the press, certain elements of the press, are just clamoring to get in print, I think these people have a right, a certain inherent right to privacy. You know, maybe I'm not a lawyer, maybe I'm not making the best constitutional argument in the world, but I don't think they want to find their names in the Mercury, the Willamette Week. I just think that's unfair to them. They can find out, you know, under the policy I announced, if they can go to the police and find out if they're on the list. And if they want to share that with a reporter, they can do that. But I just think it's an intrusion on privacy.
Commissioner Fritz? Let me speak as a father of one of those people that your police bureau disclosed the name of to the press. When you get to that point in your life where you have a child that finds themselves arrested so many times, that they become an item to the police bureau that they're conscious of and aware of, the least of your worries are if somebody from the Mercury or the Willamette Week publishes their names. You worry about if you're going to get the phone call from the coroner. So I would tell you that fortunately, I up here alone can speak to that issue. And your reasoning is not compelling. And it actually is harmful. It's helpful to people who find themselves in that place in life and their families that all be done possible to get them into treatment. It is all that saves you from getting the call from the coroner.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz?
So I have talked with Commissioner Saltzman about this, and I respect his rationale, and I respectfully disagree with it. I think that once you're in treatment, then you have a right to privacy, and that's what the Health Information Patient Privacy Act says is that you can't disclose people's names once they are in under medical care, but the arrest records are public record. I think, though, the other consideration is we don't want to have a public shaming. That's not the purpose, and I'm from what you've said, of course, that's not the purpose of publishing the list. So I don't know if there's a compromise of publishing initials with demographics or something like that so that the person themselves would know that they're eligible. I mean, I don't know if there's another compromise, but I don't know if you have a suggestion to avoid.
I do have a suggestion, and I will tell you that probably one of the most comforting things a parent could possibly read would be their child's name is on that list, and then praying that their child gets arrested and put into treatment. That doesn't violate their, as you correctly point out, Commissioner Fritz, their medical records. There are arrest records, and that's all that gets published, and that's all that the public would know.
So that's a useful point for me to try to clarify. The request is that we publish the list. A list has been referred to in the press. You've mentioned you would prefer not to release.
The list is a treatment priority list. I mean, that's okay. The whole purpose of the list is to get these people.
That is not accurate. Priority. It is a list of people who will be arrested. Once they get into jail, they are given an option as they are sitting in jail as to whether they want to remain in jail or put into treatment. It is not a treatment priority list. It is a list that you get arrested and taken to jail from if you're on. It doesn't lead to
and
treatment.
You make the list when it is viewed
when
as...
When your arrests are more than the next person on the list, you are at the head of the list. And I will tell you, we have gone from having people who have arrest records that are so long, there's hardly a number to describe it. We have worked through so many people. We're down now to what used to be the number 400 is now first on the list. That is how successful this program is.
There was a, if I could just ask the city attorney, then I promise I'll get to you, Commissioner Fish. There was, back in the day, the city could not publish lists of, like, I just have a vague recollection, it might have even been before Vera was mayor, where we could not publish certain kinds of lists. Ben?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Ellen.
Ellen's
standing ready.
Do you have any... can you answer my question or shed any other light on this issue?
Yes, Ellen Osenak, Deputy City Attorney. The issue of publishing lists of individuals who have been arrested, the prohibition is more what Commissioner Fritz referred to, which is the prohibition against defamation. There's no statutory prohibition or constitutional prohibition, but where a list of people released by the Bureau to the public could be construed by the public as a shaming or defamatory statement, you're prohibited from releasing it. And so that has been the concern all along, and that has been the reason why the public records request for the names of individuals on the list has been repeatedly declined. As far as releasing to the public, the issue about statistics and the representative socioeconomic data about the list has always been available for release, and we have released that to the public and to
so
public
we
defenders.
Have done that.
But Ellen, there has never been an instance that I'm aware of, and I've been intimately involved in this issue, where the police bureau has proactively suggested publishing a list. It has always been at the request of a media outlet. Give us those names. I'm having a hard time construing that being interpreted by a court as defamation if, at the request of a media outlet, a list is provided, and we've all agreed that that's public information. And the commissioner in charge of the police bureau already said if they are artful enough, they can get the names anyway because it's public information. Why is it considered to be defamation to comply with a lawful request from a media organization to give names that are public information?
Commissioner Leonard, respectfully, I think it has to do with the characterization of folks that are on the list and kind of what you were...
What is the characterization?
Well, kind of what you were eloquently describing, your impressions of the people on the list, that they perhaps have a history of drug abuse, that there are other associations that have been made publicly about the list that I think give rise to legitimate concerns that...
They end up on the list. They end up on the list by the number of arrests that are made.
And that's why the position, at least my position, has consistently been that the data around the list, because they are just blind data runs, and I certainly acknowledge your intimate familiarity with it, the concerns for people on the privacy, I mean, the privacy of folks on the list are real, and I understand that, you know, you have a difference of opinion about how we should guard those privacy interests and that releasing the data about them is...
To be clear, if we had a bank robber running rampant in Old Town that robbed 33 banks and was running around in Old Town, and the next person arrest, 32, were for drug use, 33 would be at the head of the list. It would have nothing to do with the fact that they were a drug user. It could be a clean and sober person. They would be at the head of that list. That list is exclusively used to put people in jail. That's what it's for. Not to provide treatment, it's to get them in jail. And once they're in jail, an assessment is made as to why they're in jail. And at that point, they decide whether or not they're a dependent person on a substance. And then they're offered the alternative to go to a treatment center. If they're a bank robber that just likes to rob banks, they remain in jail.
So, Commissioner Leonard, what you're saying is that the list is formulated, meaning it's prioritized. Folks on the list land on the list and get to the top of the list, and city works its way down based upon the repetition of their criminal record?
Correct.
Solely.
Exclusively.
And is that citywide record?
Yes.
No. It's geographic to primarily Old Town, Chinatown.
That's downtown. Not true.
No, it is true, actually. The way that the arrest statistics are generated are by specific geographic area.
But that includes we've expanded the geographic areas from Old Town to include inner southeast Portland and parts of North Portland.
Yes. Yes, I believe that's true.
Yeah, it is.
Can I just...
Commissioner Fish, yeah.
Council, I read somewhere it might have been a statement attributed to the police commissioner or someone else that were this matter a public records request to be presented to the district attorney that in our system rules on these matters, it's likely that the district attorney would consider this a public record we're compelled to disclose. Is that, in fact, your view?
It's always awkward giving legal advice.
That's
Commissioner Salson's view, which I respect. But
since you're the
she's about to disagree. I think.
Well, no, but since you're the attorney for the city, I don't want to put you in the position of disagreeing with your client. But I do want to note that if your view is that if this matter was presented to the district attorney under our public records law statute, we'd be compelled to disclose it. I don't think we should, as a council, be putting up a barrier. If that is our best guess as to how the district attorney would rule on this, which balances the public's right to know with whatever other privacy interests there are, I believe we should simply disclose the document. And I agree with Commissioner Leonard that the failure to disclose this has done more mischief than I think was ever intended in terms of the benefit of withholding this information.
So, well, my statement about the district attorney is by no means trying to read his mind. I'm just based on having been on the council for 10 years and seen many public records requests denied by us, it seems like a lot of times the district attorney overrules us. So that's kind of the genesis of the statement.
Can I just offer clarification to your motion? That to see if the council agrees with this, including the police commissioner, including our lawyer, that that this council approves the release of information regarding the arrest records of individuals citywide or in geographically defined areas based only on their arrest records and information that is public record anyway, and that in no way do we intend to characterize anyone on that list other than the fact that they've been arrested. Doesn't even mean that they've necessarily been prosecuted. It simply means that they've been arrested, and you can interpret that in a variety of different ways.
Just to clarify, it's They've been arrested three or more times within a three-month period on a specific list of crimes. But just to clarify that, it's not like arrest.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mayor, is it your intent? I understand the intent of your clarifying motion or your comment that to address the defamation problem, that we are not in any way seeking to characterize the data other than that it is based on arrest data by certain metrics.
Right. They are innocent until they have been convicted.
But I'm listening to your words, and I could get there as long as I'm clear. There is, in fact, a specific list of people that are used by the members of the service coordination team. I'm hoping it is your intent that is that list that you would disclose with that disclaimer.
Correct.
I don't want to be given out this broader list of arrest records if it's not citywide, but these certain geographic areas. I want whatever it is that the members of the service coordination team used, and I support wholeheartedly, to be that which is given to members of the press at their request with the disclaimer that you just
had. And arrest does not mean guilt or innocence.
Or drug use.
It does not assume drug use or anything else.
Or drug treatment.
Or anything. Yeah. We're just saying these folks have been arrested. There's
the list.
And to further clarify, we would be giving the list on request.
Right.
We will not be posting it on any city website.
That's right.
Correct. I would, Commissioner Saltzman.
Okay. So that motion has been clarified. The seconder agrees with clarification. Is there
addition? You got that, Ben? Do you need that?
We'll have to review the transcript.
Okay.
But, yeah,
right.
we've got a sense.
Any words of wisdom on that?
Just one point of clarification, because I'm not sure I heard the beginning of the discussion, but I think it's entirely possible and appropriate for council in a funding decision, which I think is what you all are talking about, to tie your decision to fund with a direction to the custodian of records. But because you all are not actually the custodian of that record, the records custodian has to make the decision in order for it to
be. I can introduce an ordinance if you need.
Yeah, I think you can tie it to your funding decision, but
yes.
I would just have the direction be to the custodian of records.
Let the legislative intent thus show.
Ben hasn't.
There was a question in my mind at some point during the discussion about the parliamentary relevance of the motion as I then understood it.
I don't think anyone's raised a parliamentary objection.
I understand, but I'm sorry, I was getting through my point. And, to the extent that the motion has been clarified as pertaining to the service coordinating committee
and how
this list is then used to make decisions, and this ordinance pertains to funding of the services provided by that team, then the loop was closed for me.
Okay.
So, and to the extent that is the limited aspect of the motion, then I think it is parliamentary correct to bring it up in this instance.
Germaine.
So, yeah, it's germaine.
Great.
And so with that in mind, I think we're good to go. Thank you.
Of course, the presiding officer rules on that, and the presiding officer made
I rule that it's parliamentary correct. Carly, can you please call the roll on the amendment as the tape of these proceedings will show?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
This has been a very healthy discussion, and I think it has focused on the issue in a spirit of kindness, as we were talking about this morning, and because we are trying to do the right thing by all people, and I appreciate the discussion with my colleague to the right and to the left, and all of my colleagues to the left. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I guess you can dress up the discussion any way you want, but to me, it still comes down to these are people, these are individuals, and, you know, they're job applicants. As I said, they're sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, and I don't think they necessarily want to pick up the mercury and see their names in the paper. And so I feel they have an inherent right to privacy, and therefore I vote no.
Adams.
My legislative intent on this is as well to publish on a or to provide the council on a regular basis sociodemographic information, obviously unrelated to each individual record, but the list as a whole, so that to make sure that we're going after not just sellers and buyers, but buyers and sellers and all aspects of the problem, all individual players in the problem. And I also would ask, as part of my legislative intent, that when these are released, that it contains that statement and disclaimer for those that are not here at this meeting, that these are what they are and not anything else. So those are my 2 points of legislative interest. Aye. We're at the underlying, it's been amended, the underlying emergency ordinance. Is any additional discussion on council of the underlying emergency ordinance? If not, please call the vote.
Leonard?
Well, as some might probably infer from my remarks, I think Central City Concern is the Mother Teresa of social service agencies, not just in Portland, but in the United States. I have never been aware of an agency more proactive, broad in its mission, and willing to get in to the, all I can tell you is the world of hell that people find themselves when they are addicted to drugs, alcohol, often with underlying mental illnesses. And it is this agency more than any other that looks at that as a holistic solution. They don't just provide treatment. They don't just provide housing. They don't just provide jobs. They provide treatment, housing, jobs, aftercare. It is that they are the real deal. And for that and a variety of reasons, they are, for me, just a godsend to many people in this community and their parents. Aye.
Fritz.
I'm very thankful to Commissioner Saltzman and his staff and the Bureau of Police for working on this particular ordinance, to Commissioner Leonard for initiating this program. And I think we all want to get to the point where there are no names on that list, and that we can provide services to people who want treatment. And that, to me, is the remaining gap that we need to fill. Having worked in psychiatry at OHSU for 22 years, I know there are a lot of people who want treatment and who don't want to commit crimes, and so yet cannot get into treatment because they have to wait for 6 months. So that's our next challenge, and I know that Mayor Adams is committed to working with that on that with the county. I am certainly committed to that, and we will continue to do that. This, I believe, is one-time funding in the 2009-10 budget. So again, we need to be looking forward to the next budget year and making sure that we can continue to provide this important service, which is so cost effective, as well as being compassionate and actually helping people get back to leading productive lives. Aye.
Fish?
Well, I think the case has been made that this program works, but I want to just put a little marker down, because we're going to be in budget season in the near future, and I just want to put a comparator on the table for my colleagues. We're about to spend almost $1.3 million to provide services to, I think, up to 53 units of treatment readiness. Vitally important, and a model that works. But when I asked my camping task force to look at how we could tackle the problem of 2,500 people who are currently either in shelters or on the street, $1 million would allow me to get 1,000 people into housing. So when we talk about providing enriched services to people who need it, we are talking about a substantial investment of public resources. This is a program that works, and therefore I'm going to support it. But I want my colleagues to also know that for an equivalent investment, we can tackle about 40% of the current homelessness problem in this city. And I know at every budget season we're told we don't have the resources and we have incredibly difficult choices to make. But I'm going to come back and tell you at the appropriate time what $1 million will buy in terms of dealing with the immediate crisis that we have on the streets of Portland. I vote aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 1477 is approved. Carla, can you please read the items that were pulled from the title for the first item that was pulled from the consent agenda?
1455, accept donation of services and products used for the construction of energy efficient and nature friendly single family home.
Commissioner Randy Leonard.
Well, I will be very brief. I had this on the consent calendar because I didn't think I'm learning about things that I think people won't be interested in discussing. I don't have great insight into, because it turns out there's a lot of things I thought I was going to put on consent that I shouldn't, this being now one of them. Beth Slovak from Willamette Week, who unfortunately is not here right now, to my surprise, wrote quite a posting on this program last night at Willamette Week, and of course prompted me late last evening to notify these folks to be here to talk about it. When I got the Water Bureau, it was a challenge for a variety of reasons. One of the challenges was, having grown up in Portland, I was aware just tangentially as a Portlander, as any of you would be, that there are a number of tanks around Portland that I therefore assumed were Water Bureau property. So I asked a simple question. Can I see an inventory of all Water Bureau property? And got a collective blank look from the then director and staff of the Water Bureau. We quickly after that had a new director and new staff, and I said, I think we need to have a person that we would call the property manager for the Water Bureau, given that there's never been such a position before. Tom Klutz, I'm proud to say, is the person we hired as the first ever property manager in the history of the Water Bureau. I assigned Tom to go out and first do something they'd never done before, and that is get a list of all properties that the Portland Water Bureau owns. They didn't know what they owned. That was, if you can just imagine, that took him nearly a year to compile and then get pictures of and then have descriptions of and actually put in book form, two volumes of which now sit behind my desk in my office. I then asked them to segregate those properties into three categories. One category, property we'll never sell that we always need to deliver water. Two, property we may need in the future we're not sure about but we need in reserve. And three, properties they have no reason why they own, surplus. The piece of property we're discussing today was a piece of property that fell into the third category. We have no reason to own it. We don't know why we own it. We're actually not clear why we, well, it came in from a former water district. We know that, but we didn't know why we still had it. It was sitting as a vacant piece of property, interestingly, across the street from Bonnie McKnight's house, just coincidentally. So we decided we'd sell all these surplus properties. But on this piece, we realized it could create a firestorm in that neighborhood. As I quickly put the politics of that particular piece of property together, I could imagine, because of the size of it, not one house, not two houses, not three houses, but four narrow houses going up in a neighborhood of single-story houses that were built in the late 50s, early 60s. I'm not always the greatest political forecaster, but given the particular demographics of that street, I knew where we were headed. So I said, let's call a timeout on that one, and let's do something unique. Let's put a house there, first of all. Let's build a house there ourselves instead of giving it to somebody else to make money off of. If we're going to sell it, let's build a house that reflects the quality and character of the houses in the neighborhood, which are single-story, ranch-style houses, nice houses. Second, let's build a house that reflects the current technology that's available to make it the most energy efficient as possible. So we had a solar analysis done. We had a wind analysis done. We had every analysis in the world you could think of. And I said, third, whatever design we come up with, I want the neighborhood to agree to. I want it to be a house that they don't have to sit back and wait and wonder what it's going to look like when it's done. I want them to help design it. So these folks sitting in front of us have done all three of those things. Ann Hill not only has participated in that, she went out and only the way Ann Hill can, coerced a variety of businesses to donate money, services, and materials to this project to the tune of nearly $200,000, as I recall. And I would just like to give them the opportunity to tell you just as briefly as we can where we're at in that project.
Good afternoon. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Water Bureau, and you don't need to hear from me since Randy Leonard just explained what I was going to. So I'm going to turn it over to Tom Klotz and Ann Hill. We are disposing of a piece of property, and ultimately, eventually, we will have sold this piece of property, and we will have recovered the cost or the value of the property when we sell it. Tom Klutz, our property manager, is going to talk just a little bit about the public process that we went through, and then Ann Hill will talk just a little bit about the partnerships that we've become involved in.
Good afternoon, Mayor Adams, and good afternoon, council members. As summed up by both Randy and David, we started a process nearly over a year ago in terms of kind of incubating an idea of what we could do with the pieces of property that we had around town that would be the best use of those pieces without just putting on the market and let anybody do whatever they wanted to do with those properties. And so in determining some of the sites, this one in particular, last summer had a well that was decommissioned, two wells on it that were decommissioned from a previous annexation. And after we had the ground back to where it was, we went to work on putting together the different pieces of the element of putting together the idea of putting what we call the water house. In April of 2009, we went to the Russell Neighborhood Association with Bonnie McKnight and the rest of the members. It was very well received, and presented them with three different plans of the exterior of the building for them to choose. Not really having a care in terms of how it would look, but really we wanted them to have the say in how it would fit in their neighborhood to build this to build this house. We wanted to be consistent. We wanted it to complete one of the only vacant pieces of land in that area. And so therefore we went through a public process of talking them through this, and it was very successful. We then, at the same time, we got with Bonnie, and she wrote a nice article, which is in your packet, that was in the East Portland Neighborhood News magazine, Neighborhood Association News newspaper, that lays out this plan. Along with that, you also see that we have plans in the back of that packet, which is the final exterior, and then the actual plans behind it for the interiors. We went to work on these plans with Mascor Design, and they're a local firm, and they helped us take the elements of making it fit to where our square footage needs and where they would best fit for this location. And so we went together, we put this together, and Ann's going to talk to you a little bit more about how we got the pieces of the interior and exterior that that she accomplished to get donated for us.
And are you going to talk about the environment, the energy sustainability aspects of the building? Which one are you going to do that?
You're going to write it? Yeah. Okay.
And we'll do that.
And I'll do that. And then this past Monday, we have put the water house construction, the efficiency, out to bid. So it's now out in the market. It's on the website. And that's what leads us here today. So, Ann?
Hi, my name is Ann Hill. I work for the Water Bureau. Real quick, the water house has attracted more than 30 companies and organizations who have contributed products and services to this venture. The majority of these companies are located here in the Northwest. The initial phase of the water house would not have been possible without the early support and technical assistance from the Energy Trust of Oregon, Earth Advantage Institute, the Home Builders of Metropolitan Portland's Green Building Council, Portland General Electric, Metro, and then, of course, Allen Mascord Design Associates. So this house, from its inception, because Allen Mascord had already given us a design, we were initially working for elements of what's known as a passive house, which was not entirely possible because of it already being designed. But what we did do is we worked with the Energy Trust of Oregon staff and the Earth Advantage Institute staff to make it as close to net zero as possible. So this house will reach the Earth Advantage Platinum and Energy Trust or Energy Star Platinum. So it'll be very close to being net zero. To date, more than $160,000 of materials and labor have been donated to the water house. Most notably, over $15,000 worth of tile and slab from Portland's Pratt & Larson, $12,000 worth of what's known as a mini-split heat pump, along with the installation from Marhai Distributors and SunGlow Heating and Cooling, which is a local installer here in the area, and $10,000 worth of spray foam insulation from Salem-based Western Spray Foam. We have all of the plumbing fixtures donated. We have roofing tiles from an outfit called Malarkey Roofing that actually heats their building from the methane from a BES sewage treatment plant here in the area. And the list goes on and on in the stories. Remarkably, in this climate, what a lot of folks have been interested in is, one, having a house that's in a normal neighborhood. So it's not a street of dreams and a huge mansion where people are going to walk through and say, I could never have that. So that was very exciting to many of the folks who have contributed and wanted to participate in the project. Because the house will be open for a year, it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to both look at the modeling. So energy modeling is something that's pretty important. How well do these systems work? You can design a house to be net zero, but you got to kind of watch it over a year to see how it's lived in and to watch how those how the equipment, the technical equipment works. So we'll be able to do that as well. And then finally, just working with the Energy Trust and Earth Advantage and the home builders, we'll be able to use their marketing expertise to be able to bring folks through this house throughout the year in different venues.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from council?
So what is the cost to ratepayers?
Well, there should be no cost, Commissioner. When we sell the house...
Putting aside the sale price, what's the cost to build it?
We're estimating at $200,000.
Yeah, that, but plus the donated, the donated materials are going to come in about $180,000, and we're looking at about $200,000 to build it.
We hope to market the house when it's time to sell it for about $400,000, which is between the bottom and the top of the market in that particular neighborhood. And that will recover our costs and the value of the land that we are ultimately trying to dispose of.
Who's going to live in the house for a year?
Well, the house has an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit, we haven't figured out who yet, but it will be a caretaker-type person who will be able to keep an eye on it so that it can be toured, so that it can be open, as Ann described, because it will be vacant for a year. So we'll have a caretaker in the ADU.
And then finally, I mean, the city does have a process for disposition of surplus property that often makes properties available to open space, affordable housing uses. Was this property put through that process?
It was offered to all bureaus, and no one came back with a need for it at the time.
It's in a fairly unusual spot. It's surrounded by other ranch-level houses in a neighborhood. So we did and we will continue to make sure that the properties that we have available for disposition are made available through the process that the city's identified, and only then will we be looking to dispose of them on the open market.
So that was consistent with the city's surplus property policy.
Right? Yes.
I'm just curious, since I have two bureaus that from time to time might have an interest How is that referral made under the city?
At the time, it was made through Diana Haluka, and then she, who's now retired, and she dispersed it to all the bureaus for comments, and we received comments from PDOT and from various folks stating, was there a need? And the answers were no. So.
And had Parks wanted to acquire this for just an open space, what was the price of the dirt?
The estimate of the dirt?
What would you have sold the property for, undeveloped?
When we first offered it nearly 2 years ago, obviously the market was a lot better than it is today, and we did an estimate promptly after that. It was $150,000 is what the dirt was for that area.
And I have a question for Ann. I'm not sure how, if the person's only, the caretaker's only living in the accessory dwelling unit, how will we know how the rest of the house modeling works? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to be working on that since we've got another 6 months before the house will actually be completed. So we'll be working with the technicians. And I don't know if it's going to be that the caretaker will go turn on and off furnaces or turn on and off water, or we're not quite sure how that's going to work so that we can actually model the energy use of the house. So that's one of the ideas that's come up, was to actually figure out how we could model. Because what gets difficult with modeling is apparently once a family moves in, they don't want people coming in their house all the time, and it can vary. So I don't have a succinct answer. We're looking at asking the Energy Trust staff and the Earth Advantage staff to come up with some ideas.
Well, maybe I could add one to the mix, because we just had a hearing this morning talking about 2,500 people living outside, and it seems if we've got an 1,800-square-foot house with four bedrooms and three bathrooms, that perhaps a family would agree to live there for just a year. Modeling how it's used, knowing that people would be coming in and out and that they would have to leave after a year, that might get you a better sense of what actually happens, and at the same time giving some housing to some people needing shelter. So
we'll look at that.
Thank you.
David, one other question. It's late. It's been a long day. We're all beginning to lose it. So I have to ask you, as I look at this aerial view of the waterhouse. On which structure do you intend to affix a neon sign of some kind?
It will be on the ADU, Commissioner.
Thank you. Really, that's what I thought, but I wanted it on the record.
So this is no further meaningful discussion.
Sorry.
This is an emergency ordinance to accept the donation of the services and products, and well done for getting all those donations. This is an interesting project. So please call the roll.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Great job.
Ordinance approved. What's the second item that was pulled?
1457, David.
That will be coming back as an emergency ordinance next week.
So refer it back to my office.
Unless there are objections,
1457
is held over, referred back?
Referred back to my office.
Referred back to Commissioner Leonard's office. Can you please read the title for 1465, a proclamation.
Proclaim October 2009 to be Crime Prevention Awareness Month.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Could you come forward? Thank you. In 1984, the National Crime Prevention Council designated October as National Crime Prevention Month. Since then, government agencies and various organizations have teamed up to recognize and celebrate the practice of crime prevention in an effort to create safer communities. Crime Prevention Month recognizes successful crime prevention efforts on local, state, and national levels to generate interest and enthusiasm for prevention efforts. Preventing crime starts with each individual citizen. I attended a banquet last night at which someone from the federal government came and noted how our crime levels have not risen at commensurate with our levels of unemployment and of homelessness. And he made the point that that is because, well, it's partly because people are inherently good and that they don't necessarily turn to crime immediately in the face of adversity. I believe it's also because that we have a helping community who wants to try to help people out without them having to resort to crime. And it also recognizes the efforts of each and every citizen and our crime prevention folks in Office of Neighborhood Involvement and the Bureau of Police and many other bureaus. Everyone can do something to prevent crime, from helping police identify crime problems, starting a neighborhood watch, or taking simple steps to protect their home and property. Here in Portland, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement's Crime Prevention Program and the Portland Police Bureau partner with neighborhood watches and businesses to increase awareness in our communities in an effort to make Portland a safer and more livable city. ONI crime prevention staff, Stephanie Reynolds and Kelly Ball, have in the past fiscal year processed over 3,500 requests for assistance, conducted over 200 trainings like neighborhood watches and foot patrols. And the Crime Prevention Program is hosting various safety and crime prevention events and trainings throughout the month of October. I'm going to read the proclamation, and then if Stephanie and Kelly have anything to say. Whereas the City of Portland depends on how safe we keep our homes, neighborhoods, schools, workplaces, and communities. And whereas crime and the fear of crime diminish our sense of a strong and thriving community, and whereas awareness of ways to prevent crime positively contributes to a safe and livable community, and whereas the city funds and supports a crime prevention program within the Office of Neighborhood Involvement with a mission to organize and support community partnerships to prevent crime and the fear of crime, and whereas programs like Neighborhood Watch encourage healthy, caring communities, and whereas there are hundreds of neighborhood and business watches and community patrols throughout Portland, and 17 crime prevention public safety committees, all with dedicated community members who volunteer their time to improve and maintain safety throughout Portland. And whereas the Crime Prevention's program staff organize neighborhood and business watches, community foot patrols, enhanced safety properties, problem-solving meetings, trainings, and answer questions related to the prevention of crime building and a safer Portland. And whereas the Portland Police Bureau is a strong partner and supporter of crime prevention efforts, as demonstrated by their support of neighbors who are actively involved in the safety of their neighborhoods and work with community members and city staff to resolve chronic crime issues. And whereas community members who actively pursue ways to prevent crime look out for their neighbors and get involved in their community, significantly improve the quality of life and safety on their blocks and in their neighborhoods. And whereas October is National Crime Prevention Month, now therefore Sam Adams, the mayor of Portland, City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, has declared and proclaimed October 2009 to be Crime Prevention Awareness Month. Stephanie?
Thank you very much. We're very pleased to have official recognition of National Crime Prevention Month and for it to be recognized locally as well. This is something we celebrate every year, but really we work on crime prevention all the time with our many partners. I just want to acknowledge that while I'm very proud of our staff and the hard work that we do in every neighborhood in Portland, that we really couldn't do it without partnering with the community. The community is absolutely our number one partner in doing this. They're amazing. And I also want to acknowledge the many different organizations and agencies that partner with us as well, neighborhood associations, business associations, culturally specific organizations, many city bureaus, county agencies. It just goes on and on. And it's really a group effort. And we're all very proud of the work that we do, and we keep getting better and better at it all the time. I had planned to tell you a little bit about the program, but I don't think I'll go there because the proclamation really sort of describes what we do, and you all know it anyway. I do want to say that Kelly Ball, who's our events and training supervisor, has planned some really nice activities this month in recognition of Crime Prevention Month, and I'm going to turn it over to her and let her talk about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for having us here. Kelly Ball, I'm, as Stephanie said, Training and Event Supervisor for the Crime Prevention Program. Real quickly, I would like to highlight a couple of the initiatives that we are doing for Crime Prevention Month. We have launched a webpage, and we are calling it the Crime Prevention Spotlight. And during Crime Prevention Month, we're updating it weekly with different topics that we're focusing on, topics and training opportunities. After Crime Prevention Month is over, we still want to focus on preventing crime. And so we'll be updating the website monthly with a particular topic of interest to the community and what's needed out there. And it will offer different training opportunities, resources, links. We don't want to be purely electronic, though, and so what will happen is the crime prevention coordinators will also focus on this in newsletters and when they're out talking with community members and the public and offering these trainings and opportunities and information, getting information out there. Two of the trainings that are coming up on October 26th, this next week, we are sponsoring a personal safety training, and that is open to anyone. It is going to be taught by the Women's Strength Program Coordinator, and so we're partnering with the Police Bureau and Women's Strength on that and offering that to the community. We are also offering on October 28th of next week crime prevention through environmental design, also known as SEPTED, and home safety. So things, little small changes, doesn't have to be big changes that people can do to their property, their home, or their business that will make it more crime resistant and will make it safer. And we're offering opportunities for folks to come out and learn a little bit about SEPTED and learn what they can do to their homes. So I'll just keep it short. Thank you very much.
Any other council discussion?
Well, it's worth noting that we are having the one of the best crime statistics for decades, and that's a tribute to our whole community and the staff working together. If folks want to find out more information about what the programs that Stephanie and Kelly just talked about, you can call 823-4000 and they'll put you in touch or visit the city's website. Thank you so much.
Thanks for
Thank you very much.
All right. Can you please read the title for a street vacation, item number 1467?
Vacate a portion of North Gay Avenue between North Blandina Street and North Wygant Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
This is a non-emergency, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. So before you is a street vacation for a portion of North Gay between North Blandina and North Wygant Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations. I have handed out a packet with the pictures, or coming attraction, I should say. And essentially what we have is a 60-wide foot unimproved street that's not being used nor is planned to be improved, for half of it being the east 30 feet down, as the map shows. On the last page is actually the map, and then the rest is some photos, subject to a couple of conditions. One being a sewer easement over a portion of it, as well as some street improvement, you know, sidewalk to tie it in, the sidewalk, and also a driveway entrance to the tax lot that's on the back and also shown on the map, which is tax lot 10,900. If you are looking at that white map, I'll tell you that the area, and there's also a topography map, I'll tell you that the area really does drop off towards the end of that area, and there is, like right underneath the numbers, tax lot 10,900, there is a barrier because it just literally drops off. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm more than pleased to answer them for you.
Commissioner Fritz?
It looks in the photograph that there's a utility pole towards the house inside where it would be vacated.
Uh-huh.
So what would happen to that?
What would happen to the house?
No, the utilities.
Oh, the utilities, we have a standard easement always reserved for all of our street vacations. So they would have their easement preserved.
So if the property reverts to the property owners and they want to develop, then they would have to move the utility line?
No. They would not be able to develop in the area where the utility line currently exists. And typically it's 10 feet on the center line on either side of a utility. So in the case of, for example, the sewer easement that is being required, you have a 60-foot wide unimproved street. And the way that this particular condition reads is it needs to be on the 10 feet of the westerly 10 feet of the westerly 30 feet. So it essentially allows that sewer line to go right down the middle. And so there will not be allowed to build anything on that within that area.
Isn't that where the proposed sidewalk would go, over the top of the sewer easement?
It would go across, let's see, it would be Wygen or Blandina, let's see. Yes, it would go across on Wygen, and it would tie in Wygen, but the rest of the street would require, there would not be like a full-on improved paved street. What would be required as a condition of this street vacation is that the petitioner submit for a separate application, being a street job, which would, I say street job in kind of the loosest of terms, meaning they'd have to do the sidewalk improvements, and they'd also have to allow driveway access down to tax lot 10,900, which is currently improved.
They'd have to do the sidewalk on Wygant or the sidewalk on Gay?
Wygant, as I understand it.
Colleagues, I'm concerned about the precedent here. We have a 60-foot right-of-way, and we're vacating 30 feet of it, and the stated purpose is to consolidate property, but the property is currently right-of-way.
It's unimproved right-of-way that the PBOT has determined that they have no objection to the street vacation, and they've deemed it as not being usable or currently ever going to be improved and tied into like Blandina.
But this, if and when the properties on the east side of Gay develop, might they not need more than 30 feet to put a street and sidewalk in?
Could you repeat that?
My understanding is that the properties to the east of to the west of Gay, mm-hmm. are developed, that it's not owned by the adjacent by the petitioners, that the properties to the west are developable.
I think what you're asking is about the portion that's not being proposed for a street vacation.
Right.
Can occur at that any point in time? I think that's what you're asking. Right now, tax lot 10,800, which is on the map shown, and it would be an abutting property owner, as well as tax lot 9,300, is also an abutting property owner. If they wanted to submit for a street vacation, they'd have to go through the same thing that this petitioner went through. There isn't any requirements that I know of that says that they have to pave.
No, if they want to develop the property.
If they want to develop the property, would there be street improvements required?
Yes.
I do not know the answer to that question. I would assume there would be, but until they go through that process, I don't know.
May I just ask a question, just so sure. I understand where we are here? Has there been any objection raised to this request?
No formal.
And this, we are getting the recommendation of the city engineer, the planning commission, and after having had the relevant bureaus give us an indication of whether they object or not?
Correct.
I just want to be clear procedurally.
Yes,
where we
it
are.
Definitely goes through the full notice and public review process as required by the ordinances.
And this vacation
or ODRs.
This vacation wouldn't preclude lots 10,800 and 9,300 from being developed.
No.
That's my concern is whether there would still be enough right-of-way to develop, to put sidewalks and the street through, because we have a lot of undeveloped 60-foot right-of-ways in the city. And so what my concern is the precedent that we're setting here by saying, actually, we don't need 60 feet of right-of-way. We only need 30 feet. And whether this opens it up